Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
All right. Hey, everybody. This is Don Williams, Inside College Soccer. Welcome back. You know, this is a guy that I've got on today as a guest that I think he and I have been threatening to do this for about maybe 2 years to get on a doc together. He and I both grew up in the Bay Area, a lot of friends in common, a lot of stories in common or people that we know. So I'm excited to bring on Kai Edwards today. Hey, Kai, how you doing, brother?
Good. Thanks for having me. Yeah, we've been talking about it for a while, so I'm excited to get rolling.
Yeah, threats, right? Idle threats. We decided to make it a reality. So cool. Kai, just give everybody a little bit of your background. So right now you're coaching where? You're coaching up in Utah, right?
Yep.
Southern Utah.
Head women's soccer coach at Southern Utah University in the WAC, the Western Athletic Conference.
I don't know why I said that like I don't know. I don't know why I did that. But yeah, okay. Yeah, and you've been up there 4 years now?
I completed 4 years 2 weeks ago.
Right on. And then before you were that, you were hanging out in the Bay Area, right?
I was with Neil McGuire at Cal Berkeley.
Man, I love Neil.
Before that, at Oakland just with Wampa in Michigan, and before that with Greg Ryan in Michigan.
That's some pretty good company right there, brother.
Yeah. No, I've had some exciting experiences that, you know, keep putting more tools in the toolbox.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So give us a little bit about I love your playing background, right? It's not probably what people think that maybe kids grow up dreaming about when they think of playing post high school. So where'd you grow up? What was your playing background?
Yeah, I grew up in San Pedro, which is the port of Los Angeles, a little peninsula on the map, and grew up playing every sport. My parents were big and everything from taekwondo, football, basketball, ice skating, dance, soccer, everything. I was a little pudgy boy, and at around 14 years old, I went from about 5'3", 190 to 6'1", 175 in about 10 months. So I went from rec soccer. I was AYSO, Region 6, AYSO All-Star finally as a U14 was the first time I ever made it. And ninth grade, joined Fram Soccer Club, one of the oldest and biggest clubs ever. So it was good to play for them in Palos Verdes. And then got a little better. My parents said, you know, they're only going to take me 20 minutes as long as they're driving. So I played for Coastal Quest, for Mike Simizu in Torrance. And then when I turned 17, I drove down to Wolfpack in Huntington Beach. And then 18, I drove all the way to San Diego for Nomad Soccer Club with Derek Armstrong. Ended up going to – I was younger, so I graduated 17. Went to L.A. Harbor Community College and just practiced with them and trained with them and played club for the Nomads. And then 2 years at San Francisco State, 3 at Sonoma State, 2002 National Championship team. And then went up to Washington, was a volunteer with Travis Connell, who's still there at Western Washington University. Played semi-pro in Canada for Surrey United. We were provincial champs. I think we were third in the Canadian Nationals that year. And then played for the Bellingham Blaze indoor team. It was like a semi-pro indoor league up there. So, and then concussion after concussion kind of ended the career. But yeah, I had a late start to probably high-level soccer, so I probably didn't play club till 14, 15, and was done by 24. But I got a lot of soccer in those 10 years.
Right on. So how'd you end up going from Southern California to Northern California? Because that's a people don't understand. They just think California is all the same, but it's two different worlds, SoCal
Yeah.
and no NorCal. How'd you end up making that jump?
Yeah, total different state. So I was playing the Nomads Memorial Tournament, and I was going to take my second year of junior college and play it. And to be honest, what ended up happening was I broke up with my girlfriend and didn't want to stay in the area anymore. And I was looking through paper mail, and I had a mail from Joe Hunter at San Francisco State. So I called him in about July and said, "I'm coming." And he kind of was like, "Who is this?" And I was like, "You emailed me. You saw me at the Memorial Tournament, Nomads Memorial Tournament in May. I'm coming." And he's like, "Are you in the school? Like, who are you?" So I got in the school. I had never visited, flew up by myself. And I'll never forget it. Got dropped off Oakland Airport. Hadn't really been to the Bay Area much. Definitely didn't know it. And I'm in a taxi service. And I told him, "Take me to the university in San Francisco." And he's like, "University of San Francisco?" I'm like, "Yeah, San Francisco State, that one." So he drives me over. It's the day of practice. I landed the day of the first day of practice. And I get there. He drops me off. I pay him. And I start walking around with my two bags. And I'm like, "I thought we were purple and gold, not green."
He dropped you off at USF.
Yeah, I didn't
Oh
even know there was two
no.
schools. I didn't know there was two schools.
Oh
So I'm walking
no.
around and I'm like, "Oh God." So then I got to find like 35 cents, go to a payphone, call my mom. My mom called me a knucklehead and said, "The school's purple, San Francisco State." So then I have to fly down a taxi, use like my lunch money that my mom gave me to get to practice. So I get to San Francisco State. I'm 45 minutes late to the first practice. Joe Hunter's
Great
ready to
start,
kill
great start. Joe's
me
gonna
up.
kill you.
Joe Hunter's ready to kill me. And that's because when I got to campus, I ran around for 25 minutes because I didn't know where the field was, because
Yeah,
it
you
just
wouldn't know, right? Yeah.
sunken in stadium. So I end up there, and I'm not really a big city boy. So after 2 years, I ended up going to Sonoma State, which is the bitter rival of San Francisco State. Smaller town, nice and quiet, and the champs.
Yeah, so and because Joe's a Zimmer guy, right? He's
Yeah,
part
he
of that
played at Sonoma
Zimmer,
State.
right? He's part of that Zimmer crew. Yeah, so you went to play for Marcus. So how'd that transition, how'd that conversation go, and how'd that transition end up coming about? Because that.
Yeah, the conversation didn't go well because it was the peer rival. I mean, Joe, they were each other's best man at their wedding, so they're friends, but you just don't do it in Division Two. And when I told him, he was mad. So when we played him, the first tackle was a little high on my leg that I got from what was his name, Freswick. It was a little high. And then what ended up happening was, the dream moment at San Francisco State on their senior day. I scored the goal, and then looked at Joe Hunter in the face and just stood there and stared with Matt Bernard, who was my good buddy and
Right.
the goal at the time. We stood at half field, turned to Joe and stared at him. And then Zippy, who's a alum and big time Sonoma guy, yelled from the stands, "Just so you know, that's your old player," to Joe. So it was a bitter rivalry, but it's what made especially D2 college sports exciting back then. I'm from Cal State Dominguez Hills land, and when I played them, I took a couple tackles and elbows in the back of the neck there also. So, but that's just what you get for not, for leaving your hometown. Now it's appreciated. You go in a transfer portal and leave, where back then you knew your old team was gonna give you one.
Yeah, no kidding, huh? That and so tell us about your Sonoma State experience, because that was a special group that you guys had. My son is, I think, 5 years younger than you. You were going out when he would have been coming in, so I guess he's 4 years younger than you. So we remember, dude, we followed that group and that team really closely. It was a school he always wanted to go to when he was a kid. Was Sonoma State. He's probably been on that campus 20 times. Been to a ton of Franz Hook events and clinics, and so have I. And I've known the Zimmers, shoot, maybe back when Marcus first started. So how'd that group come together? Because that was a really special group.
Yeah, I mean, I was there. I was in college for 6 years, so I was a little super duper senior. So I graduated in 03.
Oh,
But
there you
yeah, I
go.
got there my first year in 01. I was a sub. I was going from being a box to box, starting 90-minute player, holding mid at San Francisco State to a target striker at Sonoma State. And I was a sub. I was a backup. I had to learn into buying into a team, which I would say we weren't as much at San Francisco State. We were very talented individuals, but Sonoma was all about the group. And I wasn't fully bought into it. And my talent kept me around, but my attitude minimized my playing time. So 01, we were the most yellow card team in the country. So we had a lack of discipline. So practice started at 6:30 in the spring AM, and then TB later Tony Bissard was MVP of the Final Four, but Tony was late a couple times. So then practice started at 5:45 and then 5:30, and next thing you know, me and Bernard and Jules were waking people up, going to their dorms at 4 o'clock in the morning because we were sick of waking up early. That group raised their level of discipline and organization and team. And we went to Puerto Vallarta at preseason trip, and things came together. People got hot at the right time, won a quality national championship. And I'd argue almost the 0-1 team was better than the 0-2 team that won it. The difference was the 0-1 team just wasn't disciplined enough. And we lost one guy, Robert Euler, who graduated from the 0-1 team, who's top player. But the team just stayed together, got more disciplined, got sharper. And I look back at that group. I'm at Southern Utah. Matt Bernard's been with the national team in U.S. club soccer. Mike Kelly's the director at Mustang. I think there's five of us, 5 to 10. Oh, Tony Bissard runs a club. Tim Maycock runs a club in Arizona. I mean,
Right.
there's 5 to 10 that are higher level running clubs and college programs. And I would say there's probably three or four that are high school coaches, so when you look back, like the education that was around that team and the demand for them to understand the game and how to play together, it branched off later to see a bunch of people running into each other at state cups and ECNL and GA events because, we were all teammates 20 years ago.
So how do you think that that experience coming from this really talented, undisciplined team to you guys had to figure it out, man, because it was only going to get worse, it sounds like, if you guys didn't figure it out as a team. Marcus is not the kind of guy to sit back and sit around and let things happen. He's going to figure out solutions. How did that affect your coaching style and your philosophy as you became a as you went into coaching?
Yeah, if I go back and analyze, I mean, I was a snot-nosed little 20-year-old, but if I go back and analyze what are some of the things maybe Marcus changed, I think he started to emphasize more his non-negotiables. Being on time, like, was always important to him, but now they had drastic penalties. We didn't change formations much. We only played 3-5-2, and with a flat three, and it was, this is how we're going to do it. Well, coach, it's not working this game. Okay, then get better. We're not changing, because you don't want to find the solution to the problem. You find the solution to the problem with your group. So I would say the intensity of, not popping back when someone fouls you, and little stuff like that, dumb yellows, kicking balls away, and stuff like that, because the penalties became so drastic, you understood how important they were to him. And because, Marcus gave a lot of people their only chance or their second chance or whatever, you shaped up pretty quickly if you wanted to be a part of it. Because you could see where the train was going, even past, the college experience. Like I said, I've been to Europe with a bunch of those guys, and a bunch of that group won a, I think it was MPSL championship with the Sonoma Soul, and a couple of them been coaching with the national teams and stuff like that. Like, you wanted to be a part of that environment forever and not alienate yourself, right? And there's a bigger environment to that, the CCA, Bakersfield from old, Dominguez, Davis, where all those Grand Canyon of old could talk about the old CCAA days. And you look at, Nicole Van Dyke, Bakersfield Stanislaus person at Washington, and you see all these, Jeremy Gunn at Stanford was at Bakersfield. You see all these CCA guys, doing amazing, Flanagan with your organization. I mean, I played for Flanagan for about 4 months in club. He was a guest coach. I tried to go there in 96, 97, and trained with them. I always had the utmost respect. He was A-League MVP, and I always knew who he was. So, like, you started to see those type of people around, and you didn't really know. I always give the example when we were in Eindhoven, Louis van Gaal, or was it Louis? No, it was I forgot the other Dutch guy. Well, De Boer, not De
Van
Boer.
Dalen, Van Dalen.
I can't remember who the coach was, but we were with Frans Hoek and Andrew Zimmer, and they were going to a meeting, and Andrew was like, "Frans, can I go with you?" And it was like a coaches meeting for Eindhoven only, like six of them. And then so Andrew starts walking, and I'm 26, and I'm just looking at Andrew, and Andrew's like, "Come on." And I just stood, he goes, "Shut your mouth." And I walked right next to Andrew. We walked into a boardroom. I sat there, quiet as can be. You could tell they asked, "Why am I there?" in Dutch to someone. Frans looked over at me, told Andrew basically, "Make sure he shuts up." I sat in PSV Eindhoven meeting 2 days before Ajax for an hour and a half. The guys, everyone else we were with, go out, whatever. I come back and they're like, "Where have you been?" I was like, "Ah, you don't want to know." But it was one of those things where you're like, sometimes just latching on to someone opens your experience of life that you can never imagine.
100%. That's a great story, and it's really personal for me because that's kind of what I did when I met Andrew and those guys. It's like I just wanted to follow them around all the time, be where they were at, meet the people that they were meeting, because the education that I got through that, I don't know, might surpass my A and my United Soccer Coaches and all of those certifications. That education with those guys might have surpassed all of that for
I
sure.
mean, I learned more with the Zimmer brothers in collective than I have in any other experience or environment, because especially those four. But you had Trish. I worked with Trish, Marcus's wife. I worked with Chris's wife, and little kickers, and what Andrew's wife brings to the organizational side. And so, like, I mean, you just hang around them. I've been to about eight Christmas dinners with them and stuff like that. I mean, it's osmosis almost, right? So yeah, those experiences that you don't even know till, you look at Facebook 10 years later and you're like, "I was at a Dortmund game, like with Andrew in the yellow. What? How? Like, that's unthinkable for me to even try to create now." But some of those experiences definitely shaped my love of the game.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I love that. I love that. So let's fast forward a little bit. Now, I'm going all off of memory, dude. That's the way I do these things quite often if I know the person. But your first head coach gig was St. Mary's?
Yep, I was the associate head coach at Santa Barbara, UC Santa Barbara with Paul Stumpf. We made the NCAA tournament for the first time in a while and got the head coach of St. Mary's College. I was one of the youngest Division I head coaches in the country, especially as a Black head coach. I was 28 when I got the job, and at the time, the WCC was the number two ranked conference in the country, ahead of the Pac-10, right behind the ACC. So I walked into a juggernaut.
You did. I want to talk about that, 'cause I know that wasn't all. I mean, dude, we followed you so closely. A, we were all like, holy crap, Kai got this gig. Like you said, you were so young, man, and didn't have a ton of experience, and you were walking to, people talk about the Power Four and the Power Five. I always say WCC makes it Power Six and now Power Five. Tell me what other conference has more titles that doesn't have the basketball and football tradition that the other Power Four have. And it is one of the toughest conferences in the country, especially for women's soccer. And here you are, 28 years old, walking into it. And I want to hear a little bit about from your perspective. We've never talked about this, Kai. I've never asked you, because I know there were painful moments, man, that came out of
100%.
it. So I never asked because I didn't know how painful it was. But now I'm going to ask. Tell me what you walked into, what you learned, and what you came away from that with.
Yeah, no, 100%. They're painful, and I'm one of those people that live out the philosophy. I don't think I've ever said, like, you have nothing to lose, you know, like at a halftime speech or stuff like that, because then you're taking the pressure off yourself. I had everything to lose. I had my career to lose. I had my livelihood to lose. I had everything to lose, right? And that was the pressure that I don't know if I understood it at the beginning. I understood it about 1 month into the job, 100%, right? And, like, there's no preparation to get ready for Julie, well, she was Johnson back then, but Julie Ertz and Ashley Hatch and Lynn Williams and Stephanie Oates in a 9-day period, right? And I think attacking-wise, I was as prepared as I was going to be. My teams could attack. I didn't think my teams could possess. We didn't always possess in the correct spots, but we played with bravery, almost blindness. My defending was horrendous. As a coach, I ended up handing it over to Scott Alexander and then Missy after that, because I just wasn't good at it. I had no true respect for set pieces. I thought they were just something you did. Now that I worked for Greg Ryan, now I'm the opposite. We spent all day on them. I didn't understand scheduling until I sat down with Ada Greenwood from USD at the time and Mike Friesen, San Diego State, and why you schedule and, you know, what are the disadvantages of a private school going on the road to play two Power Five schools in the same weekend, just the number of players you have to play against. And there was just lesson after lesson. We could beat, I think we tied Bakersfield once, or San Jose State, and I was like, well, and we had no reason to. And it was a new lesson. How do I prepare my team? Well, what was I doing? I had Cal and Stanford the next weekend, right? I had Alex Morgan and Kristen Press the next weekend. So I'm like super focused on that. We lose to Bakersfield. Well, we come back, we lose to Stanford 1-0, tie Alex Morgan's Cal team, number 10 in the country. But we were so inconsistent, but that was consistent with who I was at the time. I was inconsistent in standards and sharpness because I didn't understand them all, and I was picking and choosing, well, let's do attacking for the next 4 weeks and defending for 20 minutes and then be upset on why we lost 2-1, right? And so I learned through, you know, getting – I think it was my third game ever. First game we beat Pacific on the road. We lose to Denver at Denver 2-1. And then we play Colorado as Nikki Marshall. They're in the Big 12 at the time. And they, she had a hat trick 8 minutes in. We lose, I think it was 9-1. And the next weekend we have A&M in Texas. And I was like, this job is difficult. Well, the next weekend we get going. We beat Texas, who's number 15 in the country, 2-1, outshoot them 12-6. Go to A&M, lose 1-0 on a late PK, bogus. But like, I was riding the wave of all that, and you just learn a lot. Like, you can't sustain that emotion all the time. But, like, scheduling ended up being a key part of it. Player management, staff management. I was lucky. I had Scott Alexander for 4 years, Missy for 2 or 3, Laura for 3. I had 3 or 4 of the same staff for 6 years. But volunteers changed. But you just learn by just getting your butt kicked. By Jerry Smith, who changed formations 12 times in a game versus us, you know, and I did it twice. And then I was like, oh, am I outthinking myself? Am I thinking too much, too little? It was painful. But would I give it up? No. Like, would I have given it up right when I lost my job? Yeah, of course, because you're like, I have no job. But I look back now and I'm like, yeah, am I a little callous from things? Of course. Am I more understanding of leadership and training and, you know, cycles of training over a year and micro and macro? Yeah. Before, I just competed, connected passes, and tried to score goals. That was all we worked on. Right. So, which was fine versus some teams, but versus Ada and Tim Ward and, you know, Portland was number 2 in the country, who we ended up tying 1-1, probably my best result ever. But like, you learn, like, you can't just be emotional about everything. But I also wanted to stay me, which is stay emotional. Just don't be overly emotional about everything and pick and choose. So yeah, it was an experience. And then my contract ran out, and they just didn't renew it, which is okay. It happens. But that's where I say, yeah, no, I had a lot to lose. It wasn't your first job. You're 28. You have forever. No, you had a lot to lose, especially as a African-American coach. You don't get many extra opportunities. So I thought it was over. I won't lie. I went on a little binger for the next 2 days. Best advice I ever got was from Jerry Smith. I called him that night and he said, stay in your house. Don't leave your house. Do what you got to do. So I stayed there for 2 days. Then I came out of my hole 2 days later, turned on my phone, had a bunch of, you know, support from people, had five job offers. And then I just went back to work and climbed back to a level that the guy who did not renew my contract at St. Mary's has been my reference at two or three of my last jobs.
Wow.
Which is an amazing, you know, battle back. And whatever the reason it wasn't renewed, you know, wins, losses, you know, scale, whatever, to get his name on your reference. And that's how I got the job here. He called her and was like, yeah, you know, he cracked some eggs, he worked, he battled, he did what was asked, he got his better. And sometimes the person who shops for the meal, cooks the meal, can't always be the one who eats it. Right. And it was just that time, but he can coach. He does it the right way. And he should be considered for every job after that, which was the greatest respect ever.
I want to talk about one piece that you mentioned, and that is the player management, the man management. Because we were going after or talking to, when I was at Cal State East Bay, when you were there, and you know, a lot of the same people in the Bay Area and a lot of the same players. And then later on at Southern Utah, sent you a player that we knew about, we found out about. So I got to hear the two sides of Kai Edwards so many years later, and how you manage players then and how you manage players now, what you've learned in between. And I think that this is a piece that so many young coaches, Kai, don't quite grasp when they're younger. And that I absolutely did not understand. I thought it was all about the football. And the more I knew about the football, the more players would respect me and the more games we would win. And I was studying the football. And I don't know how many years it was, a lot longer than you. It took me a lot longer than you to realize player management was important. But I want to talk about that piece of it. What hard lessons you learned at St. Mary's, and then how that grew along the way to the coach that you are now when it comes to dealing with people.
Yeah. You know, I think it took, when I left St. Mary's, I went to Arizona State and was a special director to the assistant. I made up my title. Kevin Boy let me make up a title. It didn't matter. I couldn't coach and I was a volunteer. So I was the special assistant to the head coach. That's what it was. And I just sat and watched him manage players and staff. And at the time, Blair was coming back from being a head coach at New Mexico State. He had Allie Maxwell, who was an awesome goalkeeper coach. He had Kelly Cagle, the old Virginia Tech head coach, as our sports psychologist. He had me he had four Division I head coaches on staff, right? So I saw how he kind of managed, you know, everything from when is it time to get information and when is it time to give, right? You know, when is it time to bring the whole team in on a decision and when is the time to not, right? Or whatever that is. So I learned a lot from him. Him and I would say Wampa at Oakland and Neil at Cal, a lot. And just for a couple things, when I look back at St. Mary's, there's some things I'm like, yeah, I did that right. I don't think I would change it, because I also don't think there's a right or wrong sometimes. And then there's some things I'm like, oh, dude, I messed it up. That was just bad, right? Now, when I look at some of my situations I've had here, because when you take over a program, you're going to have roster movement, especially we were the lowest RPI team this side of the Mississippi when I took over. So there was going to be roster movement. Well, one thing, we work with a guy, Greg, who's a sports performance guy. He meets with our leadership group. I meet with him all the time. We talk. We had him at Cal, so he's unbelievable. And I'll never forget what he said one day, because you're in a high-performing team environment. Sometimes you have to let people go, which I was coming from St. Mary's where I let people go. So my first 2 years here, I'm like, no, I'm not. I got two people in my first 2.5 years here. I never cut him. I was like, we're going to find a way. If you want to find a way, I'll find a way. And then he gave me this feedback of, at some point, you're also taking away from the people who are all in and everything. So set your non-negotiables. Give them time to hit your non-negotiables. Give them a way to get there. But if they choose not to, you also have to be honest to the rest of your team and move on from people. And that's not caring. That's actually caring about the people who are there and want to be there, right? So I learned, because I, you know, obviously I went the opposite way of everyone needs to be saved. Everyone's perfect. Right. Everyone, well, in a high-performing team, that's not always true, right? And if someone shows a glimpse of going high, let's go. But if they're not, then there has to be ground rules and standards set. So I've actually gone to the way of giving them more ownership of their environment and their development, where I was a true dictator, for lack of a better term. This is how we were going to do it. This is what we're going to eat. This
part of that's how we were grown, how we were raised, though, right?
Yes. I mean, especially studying the Dutch culture. Like, this is right. What we're going to do. We're tucking our shirt in every day. Then, like, I'm like, there's some things I just don't care about. Like, where we eat on the road, I'm like, just make it quality. After that, our director of ops meets with three players on the team. They pick where, what, I don't care, right? I just stopped managing that part. I give the general of this is how much we can spend, and this is, in general, what I'd like on the menu. After that, go ahead. I haven't touched gear in 6 years. Like, they do it. I don't care what they wear. Just look somewhat the same, right? So I've started to give a little more autonomy to that and ownership to that. But also, like, we do a lot of peer-to-peer review and review of yourself. And they actually get very little, like, sit-down review from me because they get it in practice all the time, in video all the time, that, you know, we do IDPs and they fill them out. Well, it's amazing when they fill them out. Like, so you did hear everything I said, because I didn't give you that, you know. So it really shows, okay, well, you did hear what I think you do well attacking wise, what you do poorly, technical, whatever. There's a full sheet they fill out. Well, and they fill it out without our help. And then we look over it with them. We're like, okay, so you did get it. You know, where before I did the old school of, at the end of the year, we had a meeting and it was, okay, you're 7 in dribbling, you're 2 in heading, work on your left foot. And it was so generic and it was just checking a box, you know. And, you know, I've become more of, okay, what's my environment? I'm in a small, semi-religious town. You know, what is my environment? What are we going to get the best out of my town? With my team, you know, and not necessarily what we did at Oakland or Michigan, Cal, St. Mary's. Can we take some of that? Yes. But we have to make it realistic. But also, as we're managing players, they're going to manage you a bit, especially in this day and age. And not every person can be saved, but those who want the environment of a high-performing team, you give them everything. Those who don't, you have to have non-negotiables and clear lines set and boundaries where if they meet those, great, let's go forward. If they don't, then it's time that we evaluate what we're doing. And I used to think that as failure, but it's actually the number of people in the highest performing group of your team that actually appreciate you finding out what the kids actually saying, you know, when you're not there and handle it becomes immense. But yeah, you have to give clear lines.
And honestly, I think it's love that you're giving to the players that aren't meeting those standards, because can you think of a more miserable environment than somebody who loves the game and wants to play the game and then never gets to play because they just can't meet the certain standards? Maybe they're better off finding another home that does appreciate them and want them and love them, and they can begin to play. Because as a player, I can't think of a more miserable environment than not playing.
Yeah, and I think of the player me and you were talking about from SRUSA. Good player, made a mistake in high school, a decently big one. And
yeah,
our school found out right before she came. It got sent to the president of the school, the AD, before it even got to me. Then we all found out. They didn't want to allow her to school. We had a hoopla. Well, I said, well, let me talk to her. And I talked to her and said, here are basically the non-negotiables, right? Obviously, what happened can never happen again. We need to raise your awareness in some things. That could be from books, from conversation, through whatever. And as long as you show me progress, we're good. The moment you don't, you get one strike. After that, we're done.
Right.
The kid became absolute model citizen, starter, changed her life, changed her environment. Unfortunately, she did her ACL a couple times and is now medically retired and moved back closer to home. But we made the conference tournament this year, and she was one of the first people to text me.
Wow.
And I haven't seen her in 9 months. And she texted me, it was like, and all she put is, "You deserve it, coach." Right. Wow. And as a coach, you know, you almost start bawling. You're like,
I almost made me tear up right there, brother. I got chills. Like, my hair stood up. That's great.
Yeah, I'm like,
I know the whole story, and I didn't think it was going to happen at some point. I was really concerned at certain points, and I know you were too. And to have the love that you showed her come back to you is phenomenal.
Yeah. And in my head, I'm like, I failed you. You should have started here for 4 years, stuff like that. You played for basically a year and a half. We're done. And she took it as the lessons I learned in the environment. And like, even to that mini point of when we didn't know if the school was going to let her come, I remember talking to two schools in Tennessee with their coach. And I was like, no, she can play. We want her, but the school might not let me take her. Right. And, you know, and like, her parents respected that, you know, if we weren't going to be able to take her, that I was helping her find somewhere else. And, you know, and like, that's the stuff I would have never done 6 years ago. I would just be like, wow, you're just not coming. And I would have moved on. And, you know, now we have lifelong friends, and like, my kids play with their little teddy bear from Canada. And one of them's got a little mini backpack with a moose on it from Canada, you know, and they wear it all the time that her parents gave us. So yeah, those are those experiences that you start to see, you know, now that you get older and you know, your players have kids and stuff like that. You know, that, to be honest, I didn't care about, it wasn't that I didn't care about, I didn't value it highly. All I valued was, can we connect enough passes to score goals? That's what kept me up at night. That's what woke me up, whatever. Now it's a lot more of, okay, I know I'm good at that. We'll figure that out, right? Can we shore up, you know, through the DISC assessment, who should be on our team? You know, what's your past history? And we take people with checkered past, but we know it now, right? Like, we know, okay, this person's going to have this problem. What systems do we have in place? Because I was a snot-nosed, this goes back to the Zebras, snot-nosed little kid, been kicked off the team before, underperformer, whatever. And Zemer gave me the second, third chance, you know, to get there. So I look at kids sometimes and I'm like, oh, you're a JUCO player? I was a JUCO player. Like, I get it. Like, there's many reasons. You know, you were injured. Okay, I was injured. I had concussions and made it back. You know, so I start to look at them more as an individual situation more than a collective idea.
I love that, Kai. I want to ask you something. And Kai, in your current situation, maybe you can't answer this, and maybe you're not comfortable answering this, and it's completely okay if you're not. You've been coaching long enough now that you remember life before smartphones,
yes,
right? And yes. Many of us, and I've talked about this with many coaches, a lot of them private conversations, and we've talked about attitudinal shifts, or maybe they're perceptional shifts of how players act and interact now versus pre-smartphone. And how difficult, how much more difficult it's made the job, and how we have to be more flexible and adapt and make adaptations to accommodate how the generation that we're coaching now is growing up, and how the smartphone is affecting their lives. Can you talk about that at all, and maybe how you've had to adapt from pre-smartphones to the current player? And maybe you haven't noticed a difference. Maybe it's all superficial. That I'm observing, but
yeah, no, I definitely, I still remember getting, you know, NLIs and a fax. I remember a kid committing on a pager trying to spell out yes. So yeah, no, I was definitely in that era, watching cassette tape or video cassettes. I feel as though I'm in the middle of the old guard and the new guard. I'm like the dead middle at 43, but with 20 years of college experience, so I've seen a lot of it also, especially in different regions. I think it kind of goes back to like if this it was coming of age when I was at St. Mary's, right? And I was very big on put your phone down, do this, right? This is how we're gonna do it, whatever. Now I'm like, hey, a pregame walkthrough at, a new school. Let's take, you have 5 minutes to take pictures around the field with your teammate and do whatever.
Okay.
Make a star in the middle of the field. What's 5 minutes gonna kill me? I don't care. And I always like make fun. I'm like, well, I can't get in a picture. So I try to get in a couple pictures, right? Like to almost like validate or, hey, it's okay. Like at the at team dinner, I'm like, yeah, I don't care anymore because they don't care anymore. So
Right.
I'm like, I don't take their phones at night. That's who they are. Like that's who they want to be, and that's what excites them. I think it kind of goes back to instead of regulating that, create your non-negotiables and stay to that.
Okay.
So we're in the locker room, we're having a meeting, phones are down. Like full focus on me. Now, what does that translate to that? Phones are down, right? At practice, full focus of practice. What does that translate to? Should translate to your phone's on silent. Little stuff like that. Us from the hotel to the field, and 90% of them have their headphones on. And if that makes you happy, do whatever you want to do. But yeah, I think it's kind of more than non-negotiables, like alcohol, no, like we don't over-regulate because of the First Amendment, but no alcohol pictured, or paraphernalia, no red cups, no nothing. Don't tag it any. Oh, was that mine or yours?
It was probably mine, Kai. You were talking about your non-negotiables. Go back over that real quickly, because I think that's a really good one for young coaches. Is like, what are your non-negotiables, man? How do you set that in force? And then how does that get enforced? Does the team enforce it? Do you enforce it? Do you expect your captains to enforce it? Do your assistants enforce it? Or is it self-enforced? What are your non-negotiables?
Yeah, so our non-negotiables are, focus on us while it's us, focus on your life when you're with your life. And, we split our team values. They're literally split on our sheet of paper. One says life, one says high performing team. And like in life, one of our philosophies is inclusion and enjoyment and whatever. Well, in high performing team, everyone doesn't need to be included on a decision. Everyone, so we kind of separate those things. So when it comes to social media or whatever, for us, it's alcohol and paraphernalia. It looks like alcohol isn't to be posted or celebrated. After that, it's a simple respect yourself, respect your team, respect your university. And if you have to ask us, then it's probably not respect. But sometimes when you're new, you have no idea. So we have a leadership council. It's five, I think it's six now, players. It's every grade level, every position but goalkeeper, and all four dis letters are represented. And we have in-state, out-of-state, out-of-country, married, not married. And in our state, we have people part of the LDS Church and not part of it. So as close as we can, almost everyone's represented in that group. So we always say, if you have a question, start with them. Start with yourself. And if you can't answer, that's okay. Go to the leadership group. The leadership group will guide you. If they have an answer, they'll send you to an assistant or they'll tell you to go to a head, right? So I try to minimize what needs to come to me, which gives them more ownership of it, which then allows them to police, for lack of a better word, themselves in their own environments, because the only thing I can actually police is for 2 hours. It's the only thing I actually have as much control as I want. What they do on a Friday night, I have zero control. So it's setting up the non-negotiables and the environment of people around them on what those non-negotiables are, and then what comes next if those non-negotiables are hit. Yeah. So
sorry about that.
Yeah. So what I was saying is, and then you set up an environment that, if those non-negotiables aren't hit, what's next, right? And R starts with peer-to-peer review, and then assistance, and then me.
Right on, Kai. This has been, I'm gonna really encourage young coaches to try to listen to this and try to listen to your story, because and this is not blowing smoke, I've told you this in private, man. I am so proud of you and how much I've watched you grow as a coach and as a human being, and watching how the team's grown, right? And watching how you, I don't know when was the last time SUU did was a respectable team, but it's been a long time. And that's not a slag off on any coaches. I just know that it's a really difficult place to coach. It's not in the middle of New York City or Miami Beach, Florida, or Southern California, or some place that players dream of going, which means assembling a group of players that want to come play for you and will perform and buy in is not an easy place to do it. And you've done a great job there. And I really admire the job that you've done, Kai. And that's, like I say, that's not blowing smoke. I've told you this in private.
I appreciate it.
I believe in you and what you've done. So I'm going to really encourage young coaches to listen to this. You'll be at the convention, right, Kai?
I'll be at the convention. I'm doing a panel with Shelley from South Carolina. I think Marguerite from UCLA and Heather Dyke from New Mexico and me. So I don't know how I got on that group, but it's us four talking about the future of women's soccer and sports. Taking question and answers, run by Carrie Sanchez from Colorado College. And then I'm doing, which actually just got changed on me. It was supposed to be a field session. Now it's a classroom, which is a whole new challenge. So I'm doing attacking mobility, which is, it should be interesting because we didn't attack very well this year, you know? So I think one of those challenges, especially young, old, doesn't matter. How do you have confidence in your philosophy when someone can say you only scored 18 goals? How are you running a session on attacking mobility? Right. And, you know, well, we did enough to make the conference tournament, which school has never done, you know, in 15 years. The year before we scored a lot, and then in the past we have, and I expect to do it next year, you know, but are the realities of, did we score enough? No. Right. So part of my presentation, I hope, is a little unconventional, which is who I am. I'm going to point out video clips of us with poor attacking mobility, because I think a lot of sessions are always the glorification of the perfect. Right. And
yeah.
Like, I studied at Ajax for many a times, and people would leave Ajax and come home. I'm like, Ajax has it perfect. They have the perfect facility with the best players, with everything. Like, go to Hercules, go to like anywhere else. Like, but you study Ajax and Barca, like, it's perfect. Right. So I think to give people the realistic, here's some moments of greatness, great goal versus South Dakota last year. But here's where our winger didn't move correctly and we lost. Okay. Well, what did we do at training? Okay. Well, if that didn't work, what did we do next? We replaced her. Right. And I think, right, we go to the convention for the perfect YouTube training session and the perfect everything, where 95%, 99% of the people at the convention don't train or run in a perfect environment and don't have the pick of the litter of field space, balls, gear,
right,
training environment, everything, which I'm in that same position, right? So it's not, I think it's important to see, to also be realistic with yourself, because I could have easily backed out because I was supposed to, they gave me the topic in August before the season started. So by the end of the season, I could have been like, I have no credibility to run this session, right? Uh-huh. And I'm like, I actually have a lot of credibility because I've taken teams to the NCAA tournament with a good attack, and I've seen it fail. So this is what you do in both environments.
I like that. I'll look forward to sitting in on that session, man.
Yeah, perfect. Thanks again for having me.
All right, brother. I really appreciate it. Talk to you soon.